Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Welcome into the RotoWire NFL podcast for Thursday, April 8th. I'm your host, John McCagney, joined as always by Mario Puig. We are going to dive into some best ball discussion during today's podcast. Mario just put up a great piece up on the website talking about eight guys that he's fading at their current ADPs. We're also going to circle back on some rookies, some pro day workouts, and just kind of finalize putting the pieces together as the NFL draft is just 3 weeks away. But Mario, I want to kick things off at the quarterback position. You know, it's such a deep position to begin with. So for best ball, you can wait until the 10th, the 11th round even to address your QB1 on your given team. And one of those guys that's falling in that range right now is Cincinnati quarterback Joe Burrow. Obviously, he's coming off of a really, really bad-looking knee injury in week 11 of last season. So he's got a lot of weapons around him. And that's certainly something. And he showed some promise last year, of course, as well. But there are some concerns here. So where are you at with Burrow? Is he someone that you're kind of staying away from?
Yeah, I'm staying away from him because he's basically at high risk to be damaged goods. Like, I think Burrow is fine as a player, and I definitely like the idea in theory of him playing in an offense with T. Higgins, Ja'Marr Chase, Tyler Boyd. And that would more so be in 2022 onward, though, because this injury that he's trying to come back from, which happened in week 11, like late November, he would have been on a tight timeline, I think, if it had happened like 2 months earlier. If it had happened in training camp, we still would be kind of a little bit worried about this injury. Not just for the performance aspect, which we can almost take for a given that he's not going to be 100%. Like, he's, if he plays all year, he'll be like 85% Joe Burrow all year. But we can't take week one for granted, or much in particular for granted, because this is an injury that is the ACL, the MCL, I think. And Adam Schefter at the time said there was additional structural damage. Unspecified structural damage. And if you're not talking about more ligament damage or talking about bone damage, then it to me seems like you're almost necessarily leaving the possibility of like cartilage damage, which is not good. That if cartilage is compromised, it's like the bones hit each other more directly, and it can make everything about the knee just kind of more precarious. But we don't know for sure that that's involved, but there's something more than two torn ligaments, which is bad enough in itself. So this price that he's at, to be fair, there's not a big volume of best ball drafts right now. When I wrote this, I was taking like a week sample basically, and it barely got to 10 drafts. So this is not a huge sample. It's not like in a few months when we're going to have like 50, 50 or more drafts in the 1 week sample. But he's going in the top 10 rounds. And I list in the article Daniel Jones at 148, Tua Tagovailoa at 154 as better alternatives. But Burrow's also going ahead of Trevor Lawrence generally. And I only left Lawrence out because I feel like I'm just kind of, you know, beating a dead horse at this point, advocating for him. But yeah, I'm low on Daniel Jones as a player, but at 148, he's pretty much even in theory the same thing as Joe Burrow. It's like with Burrow, you don't have any delusions about like, oh, he's going to have a clean, really efficient box score. You're largely investing because Cincinnati threw so many passes last year and because Burrow was running a good amount. But with Daniel Jones, you get the same thing. It's like maybe they're not going to be as aggressive. They probably won't be as aggressive on offense in terms of the pass volume, the tempo as Cincinnati. But Daniel Jones is that guy who will chuck it and run a lot. And in fantasy, at some point, that's good enough, especially in best ball, when you don't need to guess right whether Jones will be good any given week. It's the same thing as like the same theoretical upside with no injury and more than three rounds between them in the ADP. Plus, to be fair to Jones, having Kenny Golladay there will make him better. So to me, that's just such an easy call. I barely need to think about it.
Now that's a really good, pivot off of Burrow you're basically getting discount Joe Burrow with less injury risk and less uncertainty there. And then
AFC North defenses.
Yeah, God, that's a murderer's row there. I mean, NFC, you get a couple of Washington football teams, that's still not as bad as, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, and Baltimore. And then to your other point about, who's going in that same general vicinity, I'm in a best ball where I'm sure you might have heard the airplane sound. So I got my draft board up. I'm in the 19th round. And I grabbed Trevor Lawrence at the end of the 10th. Joe Burrow went four picks ahead of him. And I will never be able to get into that person's brain and understand what the thought process was there.
Well, it's the consensus at this point that you take Burrow ahead of Lawrence. And so I think crazy. It's as simple as that people don't know how to they're eager to like look at the rookies and ingest all this content about rookies, but they don't know how or don't want to on some level make the call themselves. And they look at Lawrence, they look at Burrow, they can't tell the difference. They're like, one's a first overall pick, one's a first overall pick. Look how big Burrow's numbers were in college. And they don't know how to put into context what all those details actually mean. So they fail to see the obvious fact that Trevor Lawrence is a much better player than Joe Burrow. And I understand the concern about the Jaguars, I guess, but it's just another instance of not thinking it through. It's like you should be concerned about the Bengals and their offensive line and that division and that region of the country they have to play in. Trevor Lawrence is going to be fine as a rookie. Right. I think in some ways playing in an NFL offense will be easier for him. Like I think the NFL illegal contact rules, the way that they call pass interference much more than they do in college, that's stuff that's going to make that's stuff that Trevor Lawrence can take advantage of better than almost anybody. Like I just think Trevor Lawrence, I've said this before, is like he's not comparable to any other quarterback in the NFL history. You have to think along the lines of LeBron James type prospect for what he means to football, and offense is going to be fine, or like to whatever degree Urban Meyer's offense is ill-conceived, it's still not going to be anything compared to Zach Taylor, who's a totally inept coach. So just go with the better player who's in the better situation. It's Lawrence. It's obvious to me.
And I think also part of the sort of reluctance to dive in with both feet on rookies, especially at this part of draft season, is that we don't know, where their landing spot's going to be. We know where Trevor Lawrence is going. So like that part of the equation is already solved for you. And you know that he has guys like DJ Chark. He's got LaVisca Chenault. He's got a reliable running back in James Robinson to, add another threat to the run game to soften up the defense a little bit more. So again, we know he's going there. We know that Jacksonville stunk last year, but like adding in Trevor Lawrence there just elevates that team to such a degree to where I just don't understand why he isn't going like inside the top 100 picks, honestly.
And I guess part of it, to be serious, is that people like us telling people what Trevor Lawrence doesn't really matter as much to most people. Like if what is it, Field Yates, or like if Mike Clay was telling them these things that we're saying, then it would become just like mainstream consensus. But
yeah,
because we are insane weirdos who live on the periphery, eating garbage in the shadows, people don't take us as seriously for some reason. But don't get me wrong, like when I say people are afraid to like think for themselves about the rookies, and so they kind of punt on it, they're not truly punting. They're just deferring to whatever the mainstream consensus is. They do want to be told what to think, just not by us, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep. That,
which is
that.
Fine. I don't care. Like it's not good to just listen to anybody. Don't listen to us either.
See, that sums it up beautifully. Let's go up to the top of the draft board. So if you're picking mid first round, you're probably going to be faced with a situation where McCaffrey's off the board, Kamara's off the board, Dalvin Cook is off the board, and then things get interesting. Whether it's Derrick Henry, Saquon Barkley, do you jump Travis Kelce? Do you jump a guy like Devontae Adams all the way up into the top five? But Derrick Henry's someone who's going inside the top five, and maybe we're feeling a little leery on that one.
Yeah, I am a big Derrick Henry fan. I was, you know, it wasn't that long ago that I had people on Twitter and in my article comments telling me what an idiot I was for saying Derrick Henry is good. Back when they were telling me that I was an idiot for saying Nick Chubb is good, and that I was an idiot for saying Kerryon Johnson wasn't good. That's all stuff that really happened, and I very much like to recall all the people who were intensely wrong about that situation, because it's a great source of humor to me. But it's gone a little too far now. I think that Derrick Henry is clearly an amazing player, but for best ball tens, we're talking about PPR scoring, and Derrick Henry going in the top five is kind of like categorically wrong to me in that case. If there was a such thing as a standard scoring best ball format, maybe we're talking a little differently at that point, but he's totally dependent on the run game. And that's generally fine when you're talking like, you know, 10th, 12th overall pick, something like that, especially when most years people are usually overpaying for a Miles Sanders type that they look at the pass catching volume of, and they make false conclusions on the talent of the player in question. And then, you know, with when that kind of market is occurring and you're getting Derrick Henry after that bust pick, it's like, yeah, that's a good value. That's, you're kind of getting an inch on the competition with that one pick. You can see how you're building something with that.
Yeah, you avoided the landmine.
Yeah, you avoided the landmine, and you got the gold that the person ahead of you needlessly, you know, dodged. So you taking Henry at five, though, means that you're passing on, you know, maybe it's not Kamara or Cook or McCaffrey, but it definitely is Barkley. And I'm not even a big Barkley fan, but my God, you're talking about a guy who can catch like 70 passes.
Right.
So it's like, I don't even need to believe Barkley's especially great as a runner, but I think he's, you know, clearly a pretty good runner. Like, his limitations have to do with the vision, and then athleticism is just kind of off the charts in every respect. And he, you know, got a ton of motor, breaks tackles, great pass catcher. Like, he's not nearly as dependent on the run as Derrick Henry, and his upside is categorically, you know, magnitudes better because of what he could do as a pass catcher. Like, Derrick Henry would need to outproduce Barkley as a rusher by like 500 yards and, I don't know, at least 6 touchdowns or something to safely account for the deficit that he'll have as a pass catcher in comparison. So I think you got to take Barkley, you got to take Ezekiel Elliott even, I think, over Derrick Henry. And I know all the concerns that there are with Elliott, but if he is physically able, he's going to get targets, you know. And as bad as he did last year, we generally have more reason to believe he'll do well with them, or at least, you know, much better than he did last year. So it's just a case too of people just too plainly paying last year's prices for results that are not any longer on the table. Like, you gotta imagine what you're paying for this year, because you don't have the option of just saying like, I'll take the league rushing title at fifth overall, please. It's like, that's not how it works. You don't get what Derrick Henry did last year. And it's, you know, I love him, but he's objectively coming off a very high point, while Barkley and Elliott are coming off of their like worst possible scenarios.
That's very true. And you know, I think that the Tennessee experiment could start to unravel a little bit, you know, Arthur Smith being gone, Jonnu Smith being gone, Corey Davis. I could see, you know, it's not like teams don't already load up to stop Derrick Henry to begin with, but they can do so with a little bit more impunity now, I feel like, or maybe just the running lanes that they were able to create, especially to the outside with some of that, you know, outside blocking. Maybe that doesn't work as crisply in this new offense. And Derrick Henry, for how big he is, he's actually better at just like get running off tackle. So I don't know how this all is going to work out for him, but yeah, you're paying the absolute premium for Derrick Henry if you're spending a top five pick on him. Whereas, like you said, Barkley, even though I've definitely soured on him since he came into the league, you know, it's hard to deny that, like you said, he's going to catch 70 passes. Like he's such a huge facet of that Giants offense when he's healthy. So I mean, just empirically on that alone, that's just going to give him such an advantage over a guy like Henry, who could very well regress. And like you said, he's going to need to basically repeat last year to hit that value.
Yeah, I definitely am targeting AJ Brown in that offense more so because I think the Titans are pretty clearly on a downward spiral right now, and they're stubborn enough that they're going to keep trying to get Henry to 20 carries. I think it's just that his current price presupposes that there's going to be multiple 25-yard carry games and maybe even a couple 30-carry games, more often 20-plus carries than under. And I think those high-range outcomes are much more at risk with Tennessee, not so much because of the defense selling out against the run, but because the Tennessee defense looks awful. It was so bad last year, and Mike Vrabel's idea of fixing it is to promote the linebackers coach who was already there to defensive coordinator and to cut Adoree Jackson, who went for $13 million in the open market. That is a stupid man who pushes that button. Like, there's just nothing else to there's nothing you'd say to defend it. They could have traded Adoree Jackson for some kind of pick because he was available. He went for $13 million, and they're not going to get a comp pick for that. Vrabel has no idea what he's doing. He's blowing it all up. He's just a belligerent fool. And that defense is going to be even worse, I think, this year, which statistically it's almost kind of impossible. But in terms of their talent level, it is definitely worse. And you can't just cover that up. And if you could, Vrabel would not be the guy who could think of how. It's going to get bad. They're going to lose a lot more games, I think.
Yep, they are. And going back, AJ Brown, I snagged him in the third round of this particular best.
If they're playing catch up, even like four games in a year, AJ Brown smashes his current ADP. It's too low.
He is something else, man. So yeah, I can't imagine taking some of the receivers that go ahead of him, rather than him. Or Michael Thomas went like one pick after him. It's like I'm totally out on Michael Thomas. Let's get on to another receiver who we may. Our listeners, our loyal listeners, definitely maybe could see this one coming down the pipeline. But
yeah, we can borderline skip this one. And Deontay Johnson at 45, yeah, going ahead of Julio.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this. But Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error. Get the Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Yo, Jones, it's like, don't do that. Don't. Like, I guess I should clarify, in a prior podcast, we did acknowledge some concern over whether Matt Ryan would be the quarterback all year. I think he'll be the quarterback all year at this point. Like, that contract restructure that he did, it wasn't the kind of thing that rules out the Falcons taking a quarterback at fourth overall. It actually makes it pretty reasonable for them to especially target Trey Lance or Justin Fields and just let them sit for a year. But Matt Ryan, if he plays 14 games, Julio is smashing value in, I don't know, the mid-second probably. And here he is falling into almost the fourth round with Deontay Johnson going ahead. Don't do that.
Nope, that's way overthinking it, and that will get you burned. Let's go to another receiver going about a round later than Deontay Johnson. That's Brandon Ayuk, you know, someone who had a very impressive rookie season. I think anyone could see that. But there's also contextual issues there where George Kittle was hurt for a huge chunk of the season. Debo Samuel was hurt for a chunk of the season. You know, he hurt his foot over the summer, that type of thing. So there's a lot of dysfunction in that San Francisco offense, and it kind of pumped up Brandon Ayuk maybe a little bit. But, you know, so while he is talented, what's going on with him?
Well, kind of like the Henry ADP we were talking about, it's just a case of people very clearly kind of clicking descend on last year's point totals and then making their rankings on that basis. There's just nothing at all in the evidence of that San Francisco offense to indicate that Ayuk is worth this ADP. It's inconceivable that he would have a target rate like he had last year over a sample where both George Kittle and Debo Samuel are playing. And I might have screwed something up because, I don't know, it's like I don't sleep that much, and I was looking between the game logs of these three different player pages, and it's a lot of the same letters over and over and red lines going across the screen, and it is a lot of fun, don't get me wrong, but I was trying to just cross on, like, you know, okay, Kittle and Debo were both out here, one of the two was out here, and as it turns out, it is great, I should say, that Ayuk had 96 targets and 728 snaps, and he did a good job with those targets, and he's clearly a good player. But at 55.2, he's going ahead of Tyler Lockett, who had kind of like the worst possible ending to the season, and still, I think, over a 16-game projection would be safely ahead of Ayuk. So it's like people are just drafting on vibes, like how year-end vibes, you know? It's like, man, Ayuk was hot. Lockett sucks now. I hate that guy. Cooper Kupp, he's dust. DJ Chark, he's dust. Ayuk is where it's all at. Let's go. That's I guess, how the brain works of, like, the average hype merchant on Twitter nowadays. But Ayuk at 55.2 is presupposing that 96 targets and 728 snaps. To suppose that, you have to remove Kittle and Debo from the sample, because of those 96 targets, 54 of them, which is 56.3% of his targets, occurred in the five games where neither Debo nor Kittle played. So Ayuk played only 12 games. It's not as bad as if, you know, that sounds worse if it's 16 games. It's still not great for 12, because that means he had 56.3% of his targets on 41.7% of his schedule. And then in five games where one of Kittle or Samuel sat, he had 22 targets. That's only a little bit higher than the rate that he had with both on the field, but still higher. There was four games where both Kittle and Debo Samuel that Ayuk also played, and he had 20 targets in those four games. So even if you get that up to six targets per game with both Kittle and Debo, you're not getting anywhere near the rate that this ADP is supposing. It necessarily has to subtract Debo Samuel or Kittle, and probably both.
Yeah, so that's some good mathing you did there. Probably the most mathing.
It's the only kind I can do. I can do addition and subtraction, barely.
As far as we've gotten in our lives, that's all I've needed to know how to do, I think. I don't remember how to do long division.
I failed pre-calc because I can just do that. I don't need to learn how that stuff works.
Oh, man, just adding and subtracting. So who would you be adding to your team in place of a guy like Brandon Ayuk in that range?
So in that range, it would be Tyler Lockett, Cooper Kupp, DJ Chark. Chark's barely in that range, though. He's way back at 67, which is a full round later than Ayuk, which is, it's just wrong. It's misunderstanding things in more than one respect. But DJ Chark, if he's healthy, will have a better season than Brandon Ayuk if Kittle and Debo both play more than, I don't know, 10 games. Assuming that the 49ers don't end up with some kind of insane quarterback upgrade. Which, if you believe the reporting, they definitely will not. But I'm not so certain that they take Mac Jones at three. I actually don't believe it. It's one of those things where I can tell, like, I'm probably wrong on some level. But if the 49ers take Mac Jones third overall, I'll just deny it for years. Like, I'll just go insane about it. No question.
Didn't happen.
I'm not believing it. It's too ridiculous. But it should be noted, If Brandon Ayuk is catching passes from Mac Jones, this ADP is just pure fantasy. It's not.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's good. That's going to age very poorly.
It's important also to note, there's no real solid evidence that he should be ranked ahead of Debo Samuel. Like, there's the durability concerns with Debo Samuel, but Debo Samuel was given similarly undue hype after his second year. People had people are going to say the foot was like the only thing that was wrong there, and on some level it was. But they were doing the same thing with him that they're doing with Ayuk. It's like you got to remember the other people are there. They don't exist in a Georgia Tech offense where it's like just one receiver at a time. Those guys are all competing with each other.
Yeah, and Debo by comparison is going in the early eighth round, according to...
Yeah, he's going like four rounds later than Ayuk, when if you make objective projections between the two, I bet Ayuk barely comes out ahead because Debo's good.
Yes, he really is. So yeah, that it's funny how quickly we can forget the lessons that were taught to us just a year ago. So that's pretty wild. Let's go over to Indianapolis. Obviously, they got a new quarterback situation. Let's get into their second year receiver, Michael Pittman. This one stung a little bit because I read this article after I had selected Pittman in my draft. I grabbed him at the end of the eighth. No, so let's hear it out on both sides then. What's kind of giving you the heebie-jeebies on Michael Pittman?
Well, I wasn't that high on him as a prospect, so in some sense, I'm just biased, I guess. As much as it might just be me trying to, you know, convince myself of my prior beliefs, when I look at Michael Pittman's rookie year, I don't see much in the way of promise, or at least not consistent with the kind of expectations that have been put on him. I think he's a good player. I think he can be, a positive contributor to a truly good offense, but I don't think he can carry an offense. I don't think he can really dictate the offense's baseline. I don't think he can command a high share of whatever sort of offense he might play in, because he played last year through, he had some injury trouble, I guess.
Yeah, he had a compartment syndrome, so like his calf.
Okay, yeah, so perhaps that affected him in some of these games, but he played 13 games, and I'm losing track of my numbers here, but basically the concern with him is he played a pretty healthy snap count, and his yardage trailed the snap count pretty safely. And it's not because there was like touchdown production stopping his yardage on these catches that he made. Just, he just wasn't getting that much usage, and he specifically was not generating much in the way of air yardage. Like, if you look at his numbers, they're pretty discouraging from the air yardage per snap, and
sure,
even when adjusting for the depth of target. And it's pretty dependent on yards after the catch that registered well above average. And Pittman's, he's not bad after the catch or anything, but I don't think it's likely that for his career he gives more after the catch than the average. Like, I think if anything, that's a stat that's likely to drop a little bit. But the basic problem is this 90 ADP is it's like 16 picks, so more than a round ahead of Michael Gallup, who had 300 more yards and four more touchdowns than Pittman did last year. Granted, he played Gallup played 16 games, I think, but he did that with Andy Dalton at quarterback. And I don't want to put unfair, I don't want to jinx or put unfair expectations on Dak Prescott and that horrific ankle injury he's coming back from. But it seems like he's going to be fine, knock on wood. And if Dak Prescott's at quarterback, Gallup probably belongs in, like, I don't know, this sixth, seventh round again. Going more than a round later than Pittman is, I guess I should have just said, like, take Gallup higher and not necessarily bash Pittman so much. But I think it's also egregious to take Pittman more than a round ahead of Devontae Parker, who was on like a 900-yard, five touchdown pace over 16 games, even in a year where the Dolphins struggled to throw the ball as they, tried to break into Tua. Like, Tua is going to be a little better, especially with Will Fuller there. That probably helps Parker too. If he's doing 905 touchdowns in a worst case scenario, then we should give him a more generous sort of assumption in his production. Like, we should say, like, yeah, maybe he's going to break even with what he did in 2019 and 2020, split the difference. And if he's splitting the difference, he's way ahead of Pittman. Sterling Shepard had 26 more catches and 153 more yards in 12 games than Pittman did in 13. You can get Shepard 60 picks later. And I think, I'm biased, so I don't want to hammer this point specifically, but my own personal prediction is that Paris Campbell will easily outproduce Michael Pittman on a per game basis this year. And Paris Campbell's going 100 picks later. It's as if people think he won't play. He's going to be their leading slot receiver.
You got him too. So I hedged.
Yeah, no, that's good. So when I'm bashing picks like these, like the Pittman 90 ADP, my criticism largely goes out the window when you're doing it in a pursuit, and especially when you succeed. In making the stack, like if someone's going with Pittman and 90 overall, I'm like, I don't like that. But if they do get Paris Campbell later, and I guess you would maybe go with Carson Wentz in this scenario, even though you don't really want to in vacuum for this particular
I feel I'm suddenly feeling a little overexposed to Indianapolis or more specifically to Carson Wentz, but if I just close my eyes and just look at the box score, it'll be fine, right?
From a roster construction standpoint, it makes sense, and we do have to consider the chance that we're just wrong about stuff. And if everybody's wrong about Carson Wentz, it'll be surprising, but it won't be the most shocking thing ever. There will be something more shocking this year. If Carson Wentz has a really good year, there will still be something more shocking that happens.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. I guess when it comes to Pittman, I'm just kind of betting on him being able to maybe get downfield a little bit more. I think to your point about the air yards, like that's definitely true. And you know, there have been other cases that we've, you know, dissected over the years, talking about guys after the catch, and it's like, well, he can't sustain this. Like it was a big thing with like AJ Brown or something. It's like, well, he's the kind of guy that's going to stay. I think you probably have a good point there when it comes to Pittman being, you know, in that elite yards after the catch category. He's probably a little bit more closer to league average, but yeah. I also think that, you know, catching 67% of his passes and only ending up with one touchdown, like I'm willing to just kind of bow to the variance gods and say that he had some bad touchdown luck and maybe throw a little bit of shade at Phillip Rivers, that sort of thing. Cause I don't know. I think that Pittman is, if he, you know, if that touchdown count bumps up to 5 or 6 and, you know, the target count bumps up to 80, 90, which I think it easily could, especially if he plays the full season, I think he should be able to return value. Maybe he's not the league winner, but I think he's someone that if you have him as like your, you know, kind of rotating wide receiver 3, wide receiver 4, I like the things that he can do. And if I can mention the vibes, his vibes are strong against Buffalo.
Yeah. I guess for me, it's that like, I agree with your optimism scenario as described. It's just that I don't think it requires as much imagination to see how Gallup and Parker and Shepard can all get there, at least in PPR scoring. And Shepard's case, obviously in standard, Shepard is not that interesting. 26 more catches in one less game is kind of like, I don't need to read more kind of thing, you know? So I think Pittman's fine. I think he's more like a victim of unfair expectations at the moment than like someone that I think is bad or anything.
Okay. All right. That all tracks. And again, if you're going with Pittman, maybe back him up with
he's Campbell. He's cheap. Just get Campbell anyway, but definitely if you're stacking like the Colts offense.
15th round. And you know,
it's crazy, man. It's going to be, I want to get like, I don't want to jinx Paris Campbell to have like a third insanely bad injury luck year in a row, but it seems unlikely. And especially because he's got like hurt everywhere with just like random trauma injuries. He's like car crash, concussion, broken wrist, hand, the knee tear. It's like, these are all random things that like, if it was a hamstring pull or a tear every time, or he's doing like the Gerald McCoy where he just tears his pectoral muscle 3 years in a row, that would be different. This is a guy who's clearly had bad luck, and there are not 5 better athletes in the entire NFL.
Yeah, he's crazy, crazy athletic. So good stuff there. Yeah, I will smile serenely when Paris Campbell breaks out, because I know you've been, you know, you've had to dig in your heels, and I think eventually it's going to pay off this year.
Luckily for everyone else, I'm muted, but I will never shut up if that happens, like ever. If you thought the Nick Chubb, Derrick Henry stuff is bad, you just don't understand just how bad it can get. Late. Yeah.
Let's get on over to tight end. One of last year's darlings, you could say, was Big Bob, Robert Tonyan,
Bob Tonyan. Yes.
He was awesome. Like objectively, like it was crazy for all these years where everyone's, you know, we live in Wisconsin, everyone's Matt hand wringing all the time. Why don't they have a tight end? You know, like it feels like they just will never replace JerMichael Finley or whatever. And they're just keeping chasing it, but it's never going to happen. Then Tonyan comes along and he has the crazy, what was it, the Monday night game against the Falcons where he had like 2 or 3 touchdowns, had some other really impressive games, of course. And, you know, probably one of the best waiver wires, you know, pickups of the entire 2020 season, especially in a year where tight end was just a total minefield, you know, between the Kittle injury, maybe Andrews being inconsistent on a week to week basis. There was just a lot going on at tight end. So if you could find some stability in Tonyan, then you're obviously very happy with him. But what kind of makes you a little bit concerned about him at his current ADP right now?
So Tonyan is probably good in some way or another, but his numbers should make you really suspicious of anything that kind of anything that presumes growth with his fantasy total is something that you should be pretty skeptical of, because more likely he's maxed out in pretty much every respect, because there can't possibly have been a more efficient and explosive per target season for a tight end ever. It's insane how efficient, like truly automatic, Tonyan was on a per target basis. He barely missed the 90% catch mark. He was 89.7. That's insane. Rounding up, we're calling it 90.
Yes.
And not just that, 9.9 yards per target with 11 touchdowns on those only 52 catches. So the touchdown rate is pretty much, like, it's not impossible, but the touchdown rate is pretty much as close to impossible as you can get. The catch rate and the yard for target number in conjunction with the touchdown number basically is impossible. Like, it just doesn't make sense to be catching a touchdown on every less than five of your catches and still have enough room to run to get to 9.9 yards per target. It's like those, every play that wasn't a touchdown was a big play, basically. And every target was on target. Or not to say like he didn't make good catches. Like, he did make good catches. It's just no one has ever made that many shots in a row, basically. Mm-hmm. And that indicates that he's good. And of course, like, he's working very well in this system. But you have to look at that and wonder, how is it even possible that it's this automatic? And I think some of the answer is clearly that these were schemed open a lot of the times. A lot of the times this is Matt LaFleur's play sequencing just totally pantsing the defense. And that's something that's going to continue on some level. But you have to assume that defenses are more dialed in on LaFleur this year than they were last. Like, he could still be a safely top five play caller and get results safely worse than last year. And if that's true, then Tonyan, I think, in particular, is the person who would profile for a reduction in efficiency. But he could get more target volume. Like, they, you know, if you're LaFleur, you probably should investigate a way to get Tonyan more targets. You should see how far this premise can go before the defense starts catching on and giving you worse returns. Because if you're getting 10 yards a target and a touchdown every 4.5 catches and 90% of the targets are landing, you should see how much you can do that before it starts to get to like 75% caught and, you know, 8.5 yards a target and a touchdown every 8 catches. Because then the defense is moving to stop it. And if they're not stopping it, like, why the hell not go back? But the problem is that it just doesn't seem to be structurally viable, because they're going to give probably like 20, 25 snaps a game to Mercedes Lewis, who does the blocking stuff that Tonyan doesn't really do. And they could choose to just give basically zero snaps to both Jay Sternberger and Josiah DeGuara. But if both of those guys are on the roster, those are both third round picks. And as much as we're giving Tonyan credit, we probably can't assume like Sternberger's terrible. We probably can't assume DeGuara is truly useless. It was a terrible pick, but he could probably give them some snaps, you know? So Tonyan's bigger problem than his target rate or anything last year was the fact that he played 638 snaps. And it's just hard to see how he gets over 700 or so. And if he does, even if he does, like, what is that going to mean when he's likely to have something more like a 78% catch rate and like 8.5, 9 maybe yards a target, probably more like 5 touchdowns than 11. That kind of stuff is not affordable at 90th overall.
So I'll get to you, your pivots here in a second, but I'll use this as a jumping off point, because there was a small tight end run in the ninth round, in the start of the ninth round in this most recent draft that I was doing. I went Hunter Henry with the second pick of the ninth round. Mike Gesicki went right after that. Bob Tonyan right after him. So three tight ends right in a row. Did the room get that right in terms of the order?
I feel like in most drafts, Tonyan goes ahead of those guys, but I would take Hunter Henry for sure over Tonyan. I don't know about Gesicki. Gesicki is a little weird to me. I think something's off with that guy. But if he's getting snaps, he's definitely producing as a pass catcher. It's just, he kind of has that Tonyan problem where it's like he doesn't get many snaps either, and the offense is not nearly as good. It's like Durham Smith or whatever plays a lot. And so Gesicki can only play so many snaps in theory. But with Hunter Henry, you're going to get a three-down player. And yeah. I think he's Like the ADPs of Hunter Henry and Jonnu Smith make no sense. I have Jonnu Smith basically alongside Hunter Henry, and yet Jonnu Smith is so in these 10 best ball 10 drafts that are in the sample, he's going 35 picks later than Tonyan. That's, I think, just kind of wild. That's crazy to me. I think Tyler Higbee going 30 picks later than Tonyan is also a little bit silly. I know everybody hates Higbee now, but the narrative on him is warped too. I mean, he was still good last year. It's just that Jared Goff got a lot worse last year, and Tyler Higbee played like four games with a broken hand. So it was so annoying watching these just scoundrels on Twitter be like, oh yeah, we told you that the Gerald Everett splits with Tyler Higbee proved that it was, you know, that he was a bust. And it's like, he broke his damn hand. Shut up. Have some, what is it, grace? I don't know what the word is. Like, you're just lowly turd people who like do cartwheels when someone breaks their hand because it proved that their splits program was an oracle. Like, you're just an idiot. But yeah, Tyler Higbee, if he doesn't break his hand, all we have here is a player who's had like Tonyan like efficiency in an offense that's about to get its baseline shot through the roof by replacing Jared Goff with Matt Stafford. So I think Higbee could be a beneficiary of that. I think otherwise Irv Smith, I'm surprised that I thought he would get more hype. I thought he would be going in an uncomfortably high part of the ADP. But if he's in this 10 draft sample going 30 picks later than Tonyan, it's like, I take Irv Smith easily over Tonyan. And if it's three rounds difference that, or, you know, 2.5 rounds difference, then that's something I'm willing to go 100% on. Like, I don't feel the need to diversify that price.
So a quick aside, Irv Smith went in the beginning of the 10th in this one, and just my own tight end strategy. I didn't go in thinking I would go this way, but I went with Mark Andrews in the 5th just because I like Mark Andrews. I want to get a share at least. And I got Lamar Jackson with my next pick as well to kind of fortify that. But yeah, I don't go into these drafts necessarily feeling compelled to go heavy at tight end, but I did go Hunter Henry in the 9th. And then we got to a point, once you get into the 11th, that there's just a group of guys that I'm not particularly enamored by, especially at some of the other skill positions. I mean, obviously, I'm not going after Jameson Crowder. Gabriel Davis would be too high there. Chuba Hubbard went in the 11th. That doesn't make a ton of sense.
Fade Hubbard now.
So I went with Kyle Pitts in the 11th. And I figured that's a best ball swing for the fence.
It is. I think it's totally reasonable. So I don't know if I'm going to end up with many Pitts shares, but I should probably make up my mind now because his price is not going to get any lower.
No
matter where he goes, that price is only going to get higher.
I felt like you're going to get him where I did.
I bet he's going to start going in like the late 8th sometimes when training camp comes around and he's wearing whatever uniform that he's wearing in the NFL, and you see him running in practice, people are going to, for some reason, it oftentimes takes just seeing the guy running in NFL garb for the people to see how fast and how big they actually are. Like, there's something about college field, college uniforms that guys just look different sometimes when they show up in the NFL setting. And Pitts is going to be one of those guys where it's like, he shows up and people are just going to say like, oh God, there's no way this guy fails. And it's probably true to say that. So I should figure it out while I still have the choice, I guess, because yeah, Pitts is not going to be a 10th round option in August, in my opinion.
No, and I do look forward to the people being like, well, rookie tight ends, don't apply the norm to this guy. That is a huge mistake. Like, he is, you know, to among tight end prospects, he's the LeBron James of them. Like, he's, no one is as big and fast and moves like him. It's like the best give him the freaking Austin Hooper treatment or something. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, he's probably the best tight end prospect since like Tony Gonzalez. Not that he's the same kind of player, he's a different looking kind of monster, but it's clear that I'm guessing some people are going to look at him and say, oh well, I remember all the hype with Eric Ebron. This is not like Ebron. I was not particularly high on Ebron, but Pitts is so good, it kind of like frightened me.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So he's something else. I look forward to it. And his faders will look pretty silly as well. Let's get to one more tight end before we move on to a little bit of rookie discussion. if there's one guy who might be able to kind of compete with Tonyan for like the maxed out efficiency, or maybe not the maxed out efficiency, but like maxed out fantasy value, or you know what the currency that he holds in the fantasy community right now, it might be Logan Thomas, but that might be the AMC stock of tight ends.
Yeah, I would say that Logan Thomas would be a fine kind of like a glue guy pick at tight end if he was going 30 or 40 picks later, but he's going about 100th overall, and it's just too obvious. It's like, it hurts me that people are falling for this. It's again, the theme that we talked about of paying for last year's prices. And I can't really imagine a much more obvious case of it than Logan Thomas, because he had a good year in fantasy terms, but only in relative fantasy terms, which is to say, like, the field at tight end was lower than it's been in years. And in that, within that context, the people who owned Thomas just had like the feeling of success and profit much greater than what his actual in a vacuum numbers would merit. You normally do not care at all about a 72 catch, 680 yard tight end. No one cares about that. But last year, it was correlated pretty heavily to winning your league. So people are kind of like riding that sentiment, that like, you know, dopamine rush, and letting it bleed into their 2021 rankings. And there's a few things that we know for certain, or, you know, close to certain. One is that Thomas will probably play fewer snaps in 2021. He led the league in tight end snaps with over 1,000. No one else had over 992, I think it was, for Darren Waller in second place. And there's something only like only 9 tight ends in the league played more than 785 snaps. So that's one of those things. It's probably more or less a reality of just the bruising nature of tight end. Guys don't play 1,000 snaps if only because they usually sprain an ankle at 900 or something like that. So I'm not saying like predict injury for Logan Thomas, but you have to project like the possibility of just complicating factors like game flow, just a little cramp in a game. Like that's all it takes to throw him off of that snap count from last year. And then within that unsustainably high snap count projection, you're taking a target volume that won't maintain either, because that's the offense where Terry McLaurin was hurt for a few games. When he was out there, the second leading receiver was like J.D. McKissic and Cam Sims. Like, you replace Cam Sims with Curtis Samuel, you get McKissic off the field a little more often for Antonio Gibson, who's going to draw more targets per snap than he did last year. It can only get worse, in my opinion, for Thomas's target share, and that's after getting less of a snap count. And the reason you can project, I think, less of a share with certainty is because Thomas wasn't actually a benefit to the offense. It was more like the offense just kind of was a, you know, run it. Let's see if Alex Smith can check down to someone for a first down, and let's do it again. See if we can get a field goal. That was what the offense was. And Logan Thomas and J.D. McKissic were the check down guys. Like, Alex Smith couldn't throw it to anywhere else, so he had to throw it to them. And the returns show that this was not productive, because he was actually below the team baseline with that. And it's kind of like the Deontay Johnson thing, where it's like people look at the target volume and they see merit, where if they looked more closely, they could see dysfunction. And for the team to improve itself, it's per se an objective to get that target count lower, because those targets as distributed are not helpful. They need to find a different place to put them in. So Washington couldn't last year, both because Smith just refuses to throw downfield and they had no one else. Now they have Ryan Fitzpatrick, who is too willing to throw downfield, and they have Curtis Samuel. And wouldn't be surprising if Kelvin Harmon or Antonio Gandy-Golden got into the picture a little bit. Yep. So with Thomas, you have to assume basically everything regresses, and he already was starting from like an artificially high imagined point. You know, it's like 72 catches, 680 yards, and it's going to get worse. It's not that hard to figure out how that one's headed. He's way too expensive.
Yep, absolutely. So that sets the record straight on Logan Thomas, a clear, obvious fade at his current ADP. And I just probably won't have any shares regardless.
I'll probably have zero.
Yeah, just not really my type of dude. Love the story. I mean, I loved watching.
Yeah, good for him. I hope he gets paid out of it or something.
Yes, 100%. But for, he's probably not going to help us get paid in terms of league winnings. not this year, at least. He might have last year, though. Let's get on over to a couple notable pro days of late and you know, kind of setting the record. You're getting close to finalizing your rookie rankings, Mario. What's the latest when it comes to Rashad Bateman? Because I feel like it's been kind of a hard and fast rule throughout draft season that it's Ja'Marr Chase and then the two Alabama guys, Jalen Waddle and Devontae Smith, however order you want to put them. And then fourth becomes a little bit more of like where you get an insight of where an analyst's head is at. And a lot of guys have had Rashad Bateman kind of locked into their fourth spot. And a lot of that, you know, not necessarily all of it had to do with, but you know, he was a guy that was listed at what, like 6'3", 210 pounds or something at Minnesota.
6'1", 6'2", 210, yeah.
So he was billed as a big receiver. Measures in at his pro day, 6'1", 190. So that empirically changes the type of receiver that he is. And like, he can't play the bully ball style. Because like, you could believe the like the big receiver narrative when it came to him because he played like a big receiver in college, but you're not going to be able to, with that frame, you're not going to be able to bully guys in the NFL the way you did Big Ten cornerbacks.
Right. So the Rashad Bateman narrative has been pretty interesting for a while because he ascended at the same time that this kind of emerging draft analysis paradigm, which has been informed with a lot of good data, a lot of good reasoning, of, you know, putting a high emphasis on putting age adjusted production, you know, in the way the Bateman superfans tend to look especially at it is age breakout, which that I understand why they fixate on it as stated, but I think they get it a little wrong. To me, the breakout age doesn't really matter. You just should care about the age adjustment to the value of the production that's there. So it's like, we're kind of using synonymous terms in some points. It's like they say he didn't break out yet. I just say like he didn't play well that year, you know, or like this guy broke out late. It's like, whatever. It's production that just gets penalized because he's 22 and a half, stuff like that. So it's like, but it leads to slightly different conclusions from my frame versus theirs, because I don't feel compelled to call Rashad Bateman a top 10 pick because he had 700 yards at 18 and a half years old, like whatever it was, like 28% of the offense or something. They say like once a player clears that hurdle to the way that these people view draft analysis, it's like they become infallible at that point. Like that, according to their understanding of material reality, it's like that player must be good because they broke out at this age. Whereas I look at that and I'm like, well, especially given that he was below the team baseline, I think we can more so say Minnesota just didn't have anyone good after Tyler Johnson that year. And don't get me wrong, it was a good sign for Bateman to so much as get on the field and, you know, stay on the field the way he did that year. But the production was being sold as like this evidence of stardom that I don't think was fair. And then you talk about, yeah, the being talked about as a 210 receiver who runs a 4.39. It's like that's putting him pretty specifically in like a Justin Jefferson kind of category as a prospect if you're that athletic and you produce the way he did. And it turned out he's not 210, he's 6'1", 190. And it turned out he's not like a 4.39 guy, he's more like a 4.45 guy. And the people who were committed to this narrative of him were not deterred in any sense. Like they did not feel the need to adjust the description of him or you know, certainly didn't feel the need to like downgrade him. But I think at the very least you have to acknowledge like this is a different application, like the category of player that he is different, and that's the way I see
there's
it.
Not a lot of great names. I mean, this is obviously not like the best analysis and you shouldn't only do this, but yeah, of the guys that fit those weights of 6'1", 190, running over a 4.44, you got De'Ami Brown, who is also an unknown, and I don't think that he was viewed as the same type of receiver throughout all this. And you got Stephon Diggs. He doesn't play at all like Stephon Diggs. And then
Diggs is 16 pounds heavier, too, something like that.
We have him entered as 6'1", 191. So maybe
Stephon Diggs?
Yeah.
Oh, if that's wrong. Well, anyway, oh, yeah.
Good. Great.
No, it's in any case, though, you're right. Like the list of comps changes, and it's like people used to make comps on the basis of that 210 and the 4.39, and it's like, well, you can't just totally scrap your list of comparisons and then say everything's the same too. But the way I see it, it's like you can say that the Bateman theory is different than you thought it was and still be totally optimistic about him, which is what I am. I think he's something different than what we were being sold, but he's still something good. And I don't really understand the defensive tone around him. I think it's fair to just say he's smaller than we thought. He's going to be this kind of good player instead of the previous kind of good player that we said. And I think he will definitely be good. The way I see it, though, is he's more like a more rugged Nelson Agholor, like an Agholor who can play in traffic, basically, which should be a really good player, because if Agholor didn't suck in traffic, he would be like a borderline wide receiver one, because he could play all over the place and produce in all parts of the field. And I think that'll be Bateman. It's just that, like you said, when you're 6'1", 190, you're not doing things that Dez Bryant did. You're not doing things that 6'2", 225 guys can do. You can't do Ben Wallace stuff at 190. No. So he's going to have to win with finesse and leverage. But interesting, he does have 33-inch arms, which is really long. And when by all accounts, he's very technically refined. So you can imagine him having a good, like a much better in traffic presence than you would normally see out of a player as thin as him. Just because if he's smart about positioning the leverage, he can just play keep away with the ball at certain points in the field. So I'm as high on Rashad Bateman as I've ever been, and I've always held him in a distinctly positive regard. And yet I still came across as a harsh critic compared to some of his super fans, who his super fans were hammering specifically wide receiver one. They're saying he's as good or better than Chase. And I never really saw that option. But I do think it's fair to rank him as high as wide receiver. I am kind of unwilling to move Waddle from wide receiver two. I think Waddle's going to be just insane. Yep. But if someone wants to rank Bateman ahead of Devontae Smith, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Okay. I like that. Let's get on. You got one more guy to bring up here today. Javonte Williams.
Yeah.
You got to crack your knuckles first. Yeah.
Well, he's a good player, and I kind of resent, we talked about players getting unfair expectations and how that kind of distorts, it pollutes the discourse around that player. Sets public opinion up to go in weird directions. And I think Javonte Williams is definitely a victim of unfair expectations. And I'm leery at this point of my criticisms coming across as I don't like the guy, or that I hope he does poorly. That's very far from the case. I hope he does great, and I think he's a really good player. But the context that I'm pushing back against is this narrative, these people who are saying he's a running back one. He's better than Travis Etienne. He's Nick Chubb. He's Kareem Hunt. He's whatever we need to say today based on the pertinent comp information that we have to justify our completely unhinged fandom of him. It's people are talking about him he's just not a real person. He's some cartoon character, or some Marvel hero or something. And it's the guy is a 212-pound running back who ran a 4.58 at a pro day, and he split carries with Michael Carter for 3 years at North Carolina. So that's stuff that it doesn't mean that he's bad, but it means he's not Nick Chubb, because Nick Chubb is 227 and runs a 4.52 at the combine. And Nick Chubb torches the SEC as a true freshman, just bodies behind him for miles as a true freshman in the SEC. Javonte Williams never took over a backfield in college, and the best player he played with was Michael Carter, who people regard as a late third, early fourth round pick, something like that. And none of this is just to condemn Javonte Williams. It's just to say, have reasonable expectations. Don't put him as high as Travis Etienne, who had 70 rushing touchdowns at Clemson and dominated all of his four seasons, and especially, the last three. And after Travis Etienne weighed in heavier and ran faster 40 by 0.15 seconds, just let it go at that point. Don't make this expectation that Javonte Williams is the number one running back. And when he runs a 4.58, don't say, okay, I guess he's not Nick Chubb anymore, but now he's just Kareem Hunt.
I saw that his biggest defenders immediately just said 40 times don't matter for running backs. That just doesn't sound like you're handling this well.
A lot of them were saying, 40 times don't matter for 220-pound running backs. And then it turned out he was 212. And like, well, that doesn't matter either. It doesn't matter if he's smaller. They used to say, Travis Etienne can't be the top running back. He's not as big as Javonte Williams. Javonte Williams is smaller than Travis Etienne. Well, that doesn't matter because Javonte Williams, he runs so much tougher. He's so big and strong. And like, it's ridiculous. Like, you sound like children. Just stop it. Just be fair to the guy. Be fair to Etienne. Stop embarrassing yourself. Just adjust on the new information, okay? Just say, like, I do that all the time. I guess things about players that turn out to not be true, and then at that point I have to go, like, ah, never mind. Sorry about that. Whoops. Just do that. It's easy. And, you know, I got, like, people asking me, why do you rank Javonte Williams, like, at 18th overall in the Dynasty Rookie rankings? He's like, because the receiver class is one of the strongest I've ever seen. Kyle Pitts is in it. Trevor Lawrence is in it. Justin Fields and Trey Lance are in it. And you're asking me to put ahead of all of them a rotational back who weighs 212 pounds and doesn't break a 4.55. Like, you have to have basic standards at some point. And if you go with a process of putting a player with Javonte Williams' objective traits ahead of players like these receivers and tight ends like that, Kyle Pitts, quarterback like Trevor Lawrence, Justin Fields, you're going to make some picks that make just completely no sense to you in hindsight. You're going to wonder, what the hell was wrong with you putting, like, this is like, I don't even know how a comparable case of this would work, because I don't remember anything like this, but it's like the David Montgomery hype gone completely out of hand. And for what it's worth, I do think Javonte Williams is better than David Montgomery.
Yes.
But this stuff where people just go from Chubb to Kareem Hunt, each time you can see the way they're doing it, it's like, Kareem Hunt ran a 4.6, so it's fine if Javonte Williams runs like a 4.6. It's like, you didn't think that before. You said he was Chubb. Now that you're wrong about that, just reflect on how other things you might be wrong about, and just have some humility. Like, Kylan Hill weighed in 2 pounds heavier than Javonte Williams, ran a faster 40, was a workhorse at Mississippi State, showed more convincing pass catching work. Why is he considered like a 7th round pick and Javonte Williams still infallible? It's ridiculous. Yeah. People got to just look at the picture. Actually look at it.
See, that's all you need to do, folks. Thank you, Mario, for setting the record straight there. That is going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the RotoWire NFL podcast. We will, of course, be back next Thursday. Thanks for listening.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.